Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Saturday, July 20th, 1996. In the fireside room this evening, our speaker is Daryl Trimew. Today's session number is 5 and is titled Capital Punishment, Casting One Stone After Another. Let's listen in.
I'm an associate professor of church and society at Bride Divinity School. That's a graduate seminary of Texas Christian University. Not a Lutheran school, but nevertheless, we're happy there in terms of theological education. The session tonight, where you should now roll the tape, which I should have said earlier, the title session is Casting One Stone After Another. And of course, that makes reference to the John 8 passage, in which Jesus is tested by Pharisees by having brought into his presence a woman caught, as they say, in the very act of adultery, at which point he's queried as to whether or not she should be stoned, as it was required by the law of Moses. So that's where the title is. Casting one stone after another implies that somehow some folks did not see that Jesus' lack of enthusiasm for capital punishment was persuasive. So this presentation grows out of a presentation I made a couple of years ago, which I guess engendered in my mind an essay, which I titled Casting One Stone After Another, which is coming out in a publication in University Press of America this year. What I'd like to talk to you about is not strictly just capital punishment, but the peculiar nature of capital punishment as it has evolved in this particular country. How many of you have ever had anyone in your family murdered? Well, we're a fortunate lot. I had an aunt murdered in my father's youth. And the perpetrator was never officially charged, was never officially punished. And the murder of my Aunt Carissa has been, and I guess I'm really the only, my brothers, my brother and my sister and myself, are probably the only ones who are now going to carry that legacy forward in terms of a troubled family composition, because it really was a specter that haunted my father and his brothers and sisters from an event that happened in the late 30s right through the end of their lives. There's only one brother and sister left. So when I say that I'm against capital punishment, I try, you know, and talk about that first, because I don't want people to get the idea that I don't understand the devastation that can occur when someone takes the life of one of your loved ones, because I do understand how that can devastate families, how that devastation can last over generations and can affect communities. Well, before I get into some of the statistical stuff that'll put you to sleep, I'll try and wake you up. Namely, by talking about biblical references to capital punishment. A lot of people are aware of the fact that there are a number of Hebrew Bible passages that authorize the death penalty. You could be put to death for owning an animal that killed a person. That's in Genesis and in Exodus. For kidnapping, for giving false witness against a defendant who was charged with a death penalty trial. A stubborn son who disobeys his mother or father technically could be put to death, Exodus 21:15, or for cursing a parent, all you kids in the room, yeah. It's a good thing it's not a theocratic state, huh? Or striking a parent, you could be put to death for incest, for adultery. That'd be interesting in this day and age, for adultery, for rape, or even having intercourse during a menstrual period, you could be put to death. Death penalty is recommended for any of those. For Sabbath breaking, for witchcraft, for false claim to be a prophet. I wonder how many televangelists would survive in that kind of world. You know, for blasphemy, no freedom of religion back then, and for improperly entering, like say a non-Levite, entering a sacred space. So you seem to have a lot of references in the Hebrew Bible, in the Old Testament, that seem to authorize a death penalty. And yet when we have the first clear capital offense, namely Cain killing Abel, and Cain expresses, you know, a great deal of caution. You know, he thinks he's going to be a fugitive, that people will take his life. And yet Cain doesn't even get the death penalty for the first murder. So that what I think you find in the Old Testament and in the New Testament is, first of all, that the Bible is multivocal. That, in fact, you will have different specific commands at different points in time. So that, for instance, in the New Testament period in John 8, when John is... when Jesus is brought to make a declaration regarding the death penalty, he comes out against it. Yet we have an Acts, Stephen, who gives one of the first great sermons and witnesses, is put to death for the standard offense of blasphemy, which was clearly understood to be a capital punishment. But you can see from the New Testament that there's not a real approval of that. And indeed, you find Paul is most chagrined because of the fact that he participated in the persecution of people, including capital offenses. And of course, the most famous victim of capital punishment is Jesus Christ, probably, at least in the Western world, who of course succumbs to that final punishment. And in terms of most of your prophets and most of your apostles, most of them seem to wind up not serving long sentences like John on the Isle of Patmos. Most of them suffer capital punishment. So it seems to me that there is more than simply an implication in the Bible that capital punishment is not approved, at least in terms of the Christian God. And yet we find that Christians have participated in capital punishment for a number of centuries. In this country, you had Puritans who came here at least in part to practice religious freedom, and yet they put some Quakers to death, such as Mary Dyer, for preaching the gospel in a fashion that they did not approve. And so they inflicted upon her and other Quakers capital punishment. And in this country also, you have had, of course, a history of slavery. And one of the factors that was utilized in slavery was sometimes very, sudden, arbitrary exercise of capital punishment. Indeed, one of the things I want to point out in this presentation is that capital punishment, particularly in this country, has got a very off-color history in the sense that it has been used consistently as a form of scapegoating and not simply as one among other punishments for a number of serious crimes. And in fact, if you, I have a book that's been published and is in our bookstore, Voices of the Silence. One of my responsible selves, whose lives and moral practices I examine, is a woman who spends her whole life, Ida B. Wells Barnett, trying to get European Americans to desist from the practice of arbitrarily lynching African Americans for any number of pretexts, which unfortunately is the history in this country of lynching. Particularly, lynching picks up after, of course, slaves are freed and therefore are no longer property, and therefore there's no loss to a slave master of a loss of property when a slave is executed. And so when you look at the history of lynching in this country, you'll see that it has a distinct color. Let's take a look at that. This is a table taken from a book by Lennox Hines, Illusions of Justice. I went to law school with Lennox Hines. And he shows, he's got a compilation of states with 100 or more lynchings in the period of 1882 to 1927. And you have to understand that during this period, there's only two states that have African-American populations that even approach being equal to that of the European-American population at South Carolina and Mississippi. But in terms of lynchings, you have from Mississippi, 561 lynchings. You have 44 whites, 517 blacks. Georgia, similarly, 549 total, 39 of whom are whites, 510 are blacks. Texas, very similar. Louisiana. Basically, all of your southern states. Oklahoma, Indian Territory, is a little bit different. 141 total, 97 are whites, and only 44 blacks. Of course, the black population was not high in Oklahoma. And of course, this particular table doesn't show how many Mexican-Americans were lynched in Oklahoma during this period, or how many Native Americans were lynched. This just shows African-Americans. Similarly, you have, in the lower table, U.S. capital punishment for all offenses, murder and rape by race, excluding other ethnic groups. And here's where I think, particularly, you can see both the racial and sexual nature of capital punishment in the history of this country. From 1930 to 1939, particularly for rape, you have 10 whites were apparently executed, 115 blacks. From 1940 to 1949, 13 whites, 89 African Americans. And for 50 to 59, in other words, the total is 42 whites, 383 African Americans. And in fact, that's one of the things that Ida B. Wells Burnett pointed out during her lifelong campaign against lynching in the United States, is that oftentimes when the European American community wanted to control or intimidate the African American community, they would lynch, usually, but not always, or exclusively, an African-American male on the pretext of either rape or disrespecting a European-American woman. And so you have that, you know, disgraceful record. Well, you say, well, what does that have to do with capital punishment? Well, I would suggest to you that what it demonstrates is the establishment of what I call frangibility. And probably what we use the word more commonly, infrangibility. Infrangibility is when you have a community, a society, or a country in which every member is considered to be important, to be non-expendable, to be a sacred. Infrangibility is a state in which you have a country, a society, or a nation in which certain people are considered to be expendable and or detrimental. So that, of course, in Nazi Germany, you have a great deal of frangibility. Well, Germany throughout a lot of Europe over a number of hundreds of years, Jews were considered to be expendable, frangible. Somehow they are members of the society, but they are not. And if there is stress in society, a certain amount of scapegoating takes place and these people are eliminated. And so what I see here is evidence, again, of frangibility, that African Americans apparently were thought to need subjugation and punishment and were considered expendable.
And what I would suggest to you is that that pattern, that attitude, that process has been continued more legally through capital punishment. Because although Ida B. Wells Burnett was not successful in getting lynching stopped in the country, lynching basically has now become fairly irregular in this country. But you can see there still is a pattern of disproportionate punishment of African Americans and Hispanics and Native Americans. Death row inmates by race, this is taken from June of 1981 in Alabama, 62% are non-white, including 23 blacks, 14 whites. Florida, 16 blacks, 97 whites. Georgia, it's about even, 55 to 51, and all the way down the line till you have the total at the bottom, 337 African Americans, 446 European Americans, in a country in which the African American population is probably not higher than 14%. Most people give it about 12%. Okay. Victims in death penalty cases by race in the South. In Alabama, you have 38 whites, 3 blacks. And what this column indicates is how many people were essentially killed where the victim was white. You follow me? So, essentially, what I think this information indicates is that if you are going to commit a crime in this country, a capital offense, it is best to be a European American, and clearly you should not kill another European American. You should certainly not be a minority. You should certainly be wealthy, and you certainly should be well connected. And then I guess last but not least, while I was working on this material here at Holden, thinking through some of it, it was the summer of the O.J. Simpson problem, and I think O.J. Simpson is kind of the wave of the future, in which clearly the kind of crime he committed is typically the kind of crime historically African Americans have gotten the death penalty for, namely killing a young, attractive European American woman. And I think what O.J. Simpson's case proves, that if you have enough money in this society, even though people may be biased against you, you may be able to obtain a high enough degree of legal representation to avoid punishment, assuming you're guilty, and punishment, assuming he's innocent. And I'd like to close on that note, because I think O.J. is and the feelings about O.J. are, again, evidence of frangibility and also what I call the great racial divide. Namely, most of the census takers have discovered that approximately 70% European Americans believe O.J. was guilty, and 30% believe he was innocent, or at least shouldn't be convicted. And the opposite is true in the African American community, in which about 70% believe that O.J. was innocent, and about 30% believe O.J. probably did it and somehow escaped punishment. But what I think those statistics and this statistic indicate is that capital punishment is in particular is one of those processes that really does demonstrate frangibility in this country, a great difference in perspective. And I think it's clear that African Americans see ourselves in particular as being subject to capital punishment, both in ways that show disrespect in two ways. One, African Americans aren't sentenced to death in sufficient numbers for killing African Americans. I don't have those particular statistics in front of me to show you, but generally, oftentimes an African-American that kills another African-American will get a life sentence or some other particular sentence. It's only if they kill a European-American that they're likely to draw the death penalty. Which, you know, again, if you take the position that every human life is equal in value, if I should kill another African-American, it seems to me I should get the death penalty. Why should I be 7 times more likely to get the death penalty if I kill a European-American than if I kill an African-American? It demonstrates a lack of valuing of African-American life. And I guess basically I'll close with that, except with one last question. Namely, can anybody tell me how many European-Americans from 1619 to the present, okay, have actually been executed by the state for the murder of an African-American? Anybody want to take a stab at it?
One.
All right, we have somebody who's on top of it. You get the brass ring, unless they've executed someone else I have not heard of. It's actually one. Which again indicates the racial nature of the particular punishment. Now, this is very different than the presentation I made at the forum there, in which I argued against capital punishment in principle. In the particular essay I mentioned before, one of the things I really talk about a great deal is the Racial Justice Act, which was a piece of legislation which failed to be legislated because of lack of support. This legislation was designed to allow African Americans, Hispanics, and others who come from districts in which that particular ethnic group is disproportionately put to death to raise to an appellate court the notion that, in fact, the use of capital punishment was used in a discriminatory fashion, which, if then the court found that to be the case and agreed with their argument, would not set them free, but commute their sentence to life sentence. And would only do that, of course, until the number of African Americans put to death in that particular district was no higher than the number of European Americans put to death in that district. You see. So even the Racial Justice Act is not designed to get rid of capital punishment. But it seems to me the failure of our country to put the Racial Justice Act, to enact it, is another clear indication that it prefers the disproportionate punishment of African Americans. There's really no other way of accounting for it. Because people who are even against the death penalty could have pushed it. People who are for the death penalty could have pushed it without actually getting rid of the death penalty, at least not in principle. Well, I went 3 minutes longer than I wanted to, but I think I covered most of the bases. And, we had an open forum, we got another. How many of you are surprised about this material?
Person has been aware of the discussion at all. It's not new information. That's pretty typical. I mean, anyone who already thought it might be different was obviously not reading materials.
But I mean, I have a lot of students I teach, and they're surprised.
I'm surprised how disproportionate it was. I know it was disproportionate. I'm surprised by how very far disproportionate it is.
Yeah, I think even I was. I mean, I knew all my life it was disproportionate. But when I saw the cold, hard statistics, even I was taken aback a little bit. Other comments?
I have a question.
Sure.
The other night you mentioned 80% of Americans are in favor of capital punishment.
I didn't say that. I have heard that given, and I think that's probably accurate. I think most Americans.
Are there any racial differences on those figures?
That's a good question. Although I would imagine that African Americans are more for capital punishment than you would think, and I think a lot of that is a lot of African Americans don't know these statistics. They don't know the disproportionality of it. But I also, to be honest with you, in the research I did about the Racial Justice Act, one of the reasons why it fell through was a congressman from my old district in Newark, a guy who I know, who I ran a candidate against when I was still in Newark and doing some politicking, basically got the Congressional Caucus to not back the bill. And why did he do it? Because he was promised to have more funds for police in that area, as if more police in Newark will solve all of Newark's problems. You know, and I, from my analysis of it, it seems to me the guy just doesn't have a clue, analytically speaking. And to me, he sold his birthright for a mess of pottage, because they're going to get more police, but the problem, particularly the disproportionality in capital punishment, is going to roll on. May get worse with more police. You know, as more people are arrested. I don't know.
When was that bill put forth?
That was 94 and 95 session. Clinton hemmed and hawed, and then when no one was looking, agreed to have it dropped. well, you know, what can I say? Yes?
Well, our church just did a sign a petition. We just asked our congregation to sign a petition against capital punishment, and we did have statistics. It's really a lot closer. There's maybe 50-something that would be for it, 40 against, and a minor amount that don't know. It's not that disparate.
Could very well be.
And you know, I can't say that would be overall United States. That wouldn't be like the North, the South, East, West.
Sure.
Like, we didn't have that broken down. I guess I would just be interested, since this is an open forum, in your churches, is there any movement to get your congregation to be against capital punishment, or to do anything besides sit and say I'm against it, but I don't know what to do about it? If we're supposed to replace the old law, an eye for an eye, tooth for tooth, with forgiveness, I'm just wondering if there's any kind of movement going on.
Well, I see your hand. I'll be right with you. To answer your question, I know my particular denomination, I'm a Disciple of Christ minister, has got a statement against capital punishment. Mm-hmm. I know ELCA has got a statement against capital punishment. I know the Methodists have a statement against capital punishment. I know the Presbyterians have a statement against capital punishment. Basically, all your mainline denominations are against it, but somehow... It hasn't translated itself into public policy. Which I think gives us really another question. I mean, what does it mean when your denomination, each one of these denominations has a church and society department, or someone who looks at those kinds of issues, studies it, comes out against it, but somehow it's never instantiated, it's never established in any kind of effective manner in the congregations. Because finally, your politicians are listening to people who are riding in and people who are doing that. And if people from our congregations in large numbers did that, most of your politicians want to be reelected. That's really what they want. And if they think that everybody's against capital punishment, they'll vote it out. You know, at least that's my reading of most American politicians.
So yes, they're not hearing.
Well, I don't know if it's they're not hearing or we're not speaking.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying. They're not hearing from us.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes. You raised your hand.
Well, I was going to say in my work, I work for the Wisconsin Conference of Churches, and there is a teaching mission being set up by the state and throughout the state, throughout the religious judicatories. Of former bishops to take very active part in teaching opposition to capital punishment. So it would be going into various congregations.
Oh, good.
So, I mean, it's
well, maybe we'll see some
step,
changes.
But it's a big chasm.
Okay, yes.
Well, within the ELCA, to look at another high-profile issue, when you look at where the church as an organization stands and where the congregations stand, all you have to do is look at their efforts to prepare and complete a statement on sexuality. I mean, and you are worlds apart between the, call it the formal structure of the church and the ground roots congregations.
Yeah, you're right, but I don't want to go off the topic, you're right.
But that's simply an example of, you know, you say, well, the ELCA as a national church has a policy statement on capital punishment, and I guess my response might be, so what? Yeah, it's not the only one where there's some differences of opinion.
Yeah.
It seems to be also regional. In Minnesota, with the public policy group, we fight against these kind of issues, and we have a network of people who will write, etc., when an issue comes up. But the problem is, it doesn't necessarily filter into the individual regions or synods or whatever. It seems to be regionally, there seems to be an issue, and then people will react to that issue on whatever local level, and they'll forget they're part of the church anymore. And the second thing that happens is nobody knows how to discuss things in a church. There is no discussion. For example, on a related issue, Native Americans, racism toward Native Americans, and how that has picked up, especially with gambling and all that other related stuff. It seems to all, you know, it all falls into one big pile, you know, capital punishment, Native American issues, African American issues, etc. There is a statement similar to capital punishment that we're supposed to be in league with the people that have basically almost been genocidally wiped out. We're supposed to actually have solidarity, etc. And you put forward a statement like that, and a bishop writes to you saying, what do you mean we're supposed to be in solidarity? And you say, don't you even read the church statements? But it's a regional issue. The regional league, their own home congregations, the bishops there to keep things nice and calm, to calm the waters. It's not the job to enlighten the members, but to calm the waters and keep the congregation numbers up and keep them happy and keep them contributing into the structure.
Got that.
And if that's the case, then the social statements don't have any bearing, because when you take a strong stand, as we have in the past, there are individual congregations who have been allowed not to give in to the whole church structure. Literally, they can say, we don't want to fund that portion of what the church does. As if you could say, well, we're going to cut off this portion of Jesus because we don't like what, you know, we don't like that. And I think that happens on a very, you know, regional basis. It happens, people just react to the community. They don't see their church as relevant in these areas. And they don't know how to talk. And they don't know how to do moral deliberation. And if that is the case, then you're never going to get the kind of discussions that lead to any, you know, positive measures to deal with this. And when you ask, for example, was there any murder in your family? I do have one. It's just it was murdered by the state. So, you know, it was a Nazi Germany type thing. It's similar to the idea of how much, and I'm going to ask you this question, how much are we doing murder by the state? And how much is individual murder, because the case you're talking about may be an individual murder case based on, you know, inflicted poverty and who knows whatever factors are involved in this thing. But, you know, I see that as separate issue from the state murdering people, as in this disproportionate thing. Mm-hmm. So state sanctioned murder of a given group to me is possibly the greater problem right now.
I see your point.
See that.
The thing of capital punishment and perhaps the distinction between that and lynching, although the more I think about this, the more I think maybe there isn't that much of a distinction. You know, lynching in this country was always done with the connivance of the authorities, which people would come to a jail cell and take somebody out, and jailers would look the other way. Mm-hmm. But it still was somewhat sub rosa. It's not quite the same as saying, you know, a court saying on the 21st day of December or whatever at 6 o'clock in the morning, at the prison or whatever, you will be executed. So, you know, one of the things about capital punishment is it does have very much the aura of enforcing morality. And even the word you use, murder, would offend most of, you know, the wardens and certainly the executioners that are doing their, as they understand it, job, perhaps even their calling, their beruf, mm-hmm. you know, their ministry. They would not see themselves as murderers. As executioners, they would understand themselves as to be, you know, upholding one of the two kingdoms. yes.
Well, that raises a very real issue of our roles in this society as individuals on one hand and as members of a civil structure on another. And that's something that is very seriously wrong with American religion in general, is simply the concept of religion and church as individually voluntary activity, which I can either accept or leave. And the same is increasingly true of our civic structure, that we perceive ourselves as individuals free to associate with a national entity on a voluntary basis, or prepared and willing and able to withdraw from it at personal whim.
Well, yeah, I think you're right, yes and no. I mean, you just can't, although I saw in the paper the other day some policemen were trying to get out of paying their taxes. And there's some things you can withdraw from, and there's some things you can't. But yeah, you know, I had mentioned the Puritan execution, religious executions at the beginning of this country. And well, now there you have a kind of almost a fusion, or close to a fusion, of church and state. And I don't think anybody wants that again. But, you know, to a certain extent, I think you're correct. We may have gone to the other extreme where your religion and the pronouncements of your church are considered to be so private that, in fact, people look askance at you when you take a church stance and actually want to then have it change public policy. Mm-hmm. You know, they want you instead to come up with, you know, as Hobbes would put it, rational ideas, rules of law and rationality to make arguments for or against, say, capital punishment, but not religious ideas. And I think those are two extremes that we somehow need to avoid. One, having a theocracy on one hand, and on the other, to have a religion so privatized that it doesn't have any effect on public policy. I think we do need a certain kind of public theology, but that is also another subject. Other questions or comments on capital punishment? Yes.
If one point to argue, as you've done this evening, on pragmatic sort of fairness grounds against capital punishment, wouldn't it be more effective for the church to not just be against capital punishment, but to offer some constructive ideas about the reform of the judicial system, which is the problem seems tonight to be the loss of the confidence. You know, we don't have any sense that there's any fairness or consistency in the outcome, as your statistics seem to show.
Yeah.
What can we say to the community about how we could come up with a judicial system in which we did have confidence?
Well, something like the Racial Justice Act was kind of a quick fix.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of superficial in a way, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, but I mean, on the other hand, yes, it is superficial, but on the other hand, it would, I think, make it clear to people. I mean, for instance, one of the senators that argued against the Racial Justice Act, I believe it was a senator or state, I believe it was a U.S. representative from Florida, said, well, gee, if we really had this act enacted, since most of our the people we put to death are minorities, well, we wouldn't have capital punishment in this state at all. What he didn't realize is what he was saying is essentially we only put blacks and Hispanics to death in Florida for the most part, and occasionally we'll put a European American to death. So he was against it because, you know, he wouldn't have capital punishment. He didn't understand exactly what he was saying. Maybe he did, I don't know. It seems to me that this kind of information has to be more widely distributed. The church, I mean, to be honest with you, I hate to even admit this, but I found out that the Racial Justice Act failed just about the time it was failing. I didn't even get it, and it's my business, you know. But I don't think I even got a letter in to my congressman or anyone else in time to show support for it. But people raise these kinds of issues, but it doesn't seem to enter into the public consciousness. Everybody's talking about OJ.
Yeah.
Not the Racial Justice Act, in which most people never heard of it. It came and went, and it was, lost in the mist. I think the church does have to take a pronouncement like that, and in fact, all of these churches, Lutherans, Presbyterians, Disciples, should, because of the statements they've already written against capital punishment, should have said, yeah, we should back the Racial Justice Act as a temporary measure of protest against capital punishment. You see what I'm saying? But nobody did. And I plead guilty on that too, in terms of not rallying troops. Yes?
I probably should have raised my hand when you asked if anybody had a murder in their family, because my son-in-law's parents were murdered. And my two young men, it was an IED, they were stabbed repeatedly, both of them. But when they came to trial, my daughter and son-in-law, they were asked if they wanted them to press for the death penalty or life without parole. And they opted for life without parole because if they had been convicted and given the death penalty, they have repeated repeal after repeal. And then they have to go to court.
Sure.
So it just reopens the whole thing each time.
That's true.
And they didn't want to have to go through that.
Yeah, they sound like they're very wise. Mm-hmm. Because on average, it takes about 11 years of appeal before the appeals are exhausted. And in fact, it costs, between $60,000 and $70,000 to finally work through that process and put that person to death.
Isn't there something going now that they want to shorten that time?
And if it goes through, assuming it's constitutional, which with the Supreme Court we now have, it may be. Thanks to the Reagan-Bush era. But, what will that guarantee? If that legislation goes through and they shorten the appeal, you will get, of course, more people who either didn't get a fair trial or who were, in fact, innocent, executed. Because it cuts short some people who either get new trials, have their convictions overturned, or have their sentences commuted, those numbers decrease because, the process is going to be shortened and more people are going to be executed. So, naturally, I'm not in favor of that legislation. And perhaps this is another opportunity for the church to kind of rally the troops and talk about why that's bad legislation. That, in fact, even if we don't overturn capital punishment, we should at least make the appellate process as fair as possible. Because, I did practice, actually the first trial I was ever involved with was a capital trial. My partner was a very experienced criminal attorney and he was lead counsel. And, people do make mistakes. You have, particularly when it's an eyewitness identification, somebody will see somebody commit a crime like an armed robbery and kill a clerk. And then the police will arrest somebody since they have a description who looks very much almost just or perhaps just like the real life perpetrator. And people will honestly get up on the witness stand and say, yeah, he did it. That's sitting right there at the defendant's table. That's the man I saw shoot the clerk. And they can be very difficult to impeach because from their perspective, they're telling the truth. It's simply an honest mistake. They don't have doubt in their voice because they really do think that particular guy did it. And in some cases, of course, that guy did do it. But of course, in some instances, someone who looks like that man did it. And then you have people who are innocent simply put to death. Well, of course, you can have unjust convictions where the death penalty is not involved. And of course, that's, you know, that's a miscarriage of justice. That's a tragedy. So, you know, the length of time in which people continue to fight to have the person released has a much better chance of getting a man wrongly convicted acquitted, which, of course, doesn't happen if the person's executed. You know, if they find the killer after that, it doesn't do anything for the man who's executed or for his family. Other questions or comments?
Yeah, I think one of the points raised by the O.J. trial is something that the churches have been pointing out all along. The reason they don't suggest reviewing the legislative underpinnings is because they see that the root problem is inequity in, you know, economic distribution, etc., where if somebody actually had sufficient economic means, etc., they could actually get decent reputation, things like that, which many of the old miscarriages of justice came from, just poor attorneys. The most poor districts, you're going to get most of the convictions because the lawyers are incompetent, or they're just swamped public defenders, or the person's just been put through the system so many times, nobody wants to hear about this person anymore, they just want this person put away, or killed. Which is worse.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering whether the churches, since they see that as an underlying issue, push more toward the economic and all those other, you know, the justice and poverty and all that as underlying pinnings, and then say, well, capital punishment is wrong, but also here are some underlying problems that if you got rid of, we wouldn't be talking judicial problems. Because
we'd have
people with enough representation, education, etc., that they get more just decisions could they actually have more power.
Well, yeah, the church could do that. I think it's very, it's, you know, it gets, in terms of strategy, it's very delicate to just talk about underlying causes of poverty and crime rather than talk about specific issues. But the church could even do that by talking about getting, having the state spend more money for things like legal services and the public defender's office. I mean, that would be one way of addressing that because, you know, I know a lot of public defenders. I used to do pool work for the public defender's office. And some of the best criminal attorneys in this country are public defenders. But what do you notice about them? Part of the reason why they're some of the best is that they handle a lot of cases. And part of the reasons why they make mistakes is they handle a lot of cases. You know, and they do that because they don't have enough in the office for the level of crime we have. But, you know, you have to have a church that says justice is important, and therefore our members, our church members, must be willing to pay more in taxes to pay for a public defender's office that fairly represents people. And if you don't have a church that's willing to do that, and church members are willing to do that, then what are you? You're going to get overtaxed public defenders. You're going to get some attorneys doing pro bono work, perhaps in criminal work for which they're not, since they may be commercial lawyers, like Mike Tyson's lawyer, who was a contract lawyer. It's one of the reasons why Mike got convicted. He had absolutely the wrong kind of lawyer. I'm not saying he wasn't guilty too, but he might have put up a better fight if he had gotten the right lawyer. But you have to have a church that's willing to do that.
Right. And we can't. We have to struggle with our synodical benevolence, much less convincing people to pay taxes.
Well, but I mean, in a society like ours, in which attorneys must be paid, and in which there are pressures on them, We have a system of jousting, you know. If you don't have, if you have an overtaxed attorney, he's going to lose the joust. And therefore justice will not be carried out. I mean, it's like anything else. If you want a more just society, you have to work for it, and sometimes you have to pay for it.
I think one thing churches can do is remind ourselves that it is patriotic. It's just as patriotic to pay taxes as it is to put on a uniform.
Yeah, I agree with you, but... Well, we're moving around. Does that mean we've exhausted capital punishment?
Another issue that we have to avoid.
But it's related.
Yeah, it is related.
I just have a general question about what the churches talk about. I mean, you say, you know, we should be talking about this in our congregations. I don't know if I'm in an unusual situation now, but I'm going to be the only ELCA congregation in my town. We don't talk about anything controversial.
Well, you know, you know, it's not just Lutherans, okay? If it'll make you feel any better, it makes me feel worse to hear Lutherans say it, because I know it's true about disciples.
See, I didn't know if it was Southern. I mean, North Texas considers itself as South.
No, it's not Southern. It's not Southern. When I was growing up even, I was told in polite company they were... You know, three things you didn't talk about: sex, politics, and religion.
I'm sorry, you said something else? What was that? Come on, it sounded good. God, dude, I didn't hear that.
We're talking about
it. Back to capital punishment, I guess.
Well, I think our church actually went through the process of supposedly learning how to do moral deliberation. But I haven't noticed them using it very much since they did it, so I'm not sure. I think there's always this, there's always some people who have a fair amount of money they're putting into the church who say, well, don't really like that idea of talking about stuff like that, and then it just withers away on the vine. That's how it happens.
So money always talks?
Well, it talks with Congress, and it talks with preachers, too, or with churches.
I'm not sure pastors are well educated in that. They're well educated in preaching the word. But the question is, can they relate that to societal problems and take the educational moral stand? I think there used to be congregations like that. There are certain traditions, like the Southern Baptist tradition of black churches, who came out and understood the link completely of the Jimmy Carter's churches, things like that, who fought within the church,
right,
to understand that. There are some churches with that kind of tradition. The Methodist tradition had more societal basis. There are some traditions which have already figured it out that link exists. As a matter of fact, they don't see the big separation between a moral society and a church acting in a moral society, even though they believe in freedom of religion. And I think that goes right back to, I think that goes back to capital punishment. We don't ask a whole lot of people, of our people to pews. And a lot of times the church leadership and a lot of us who serve on committees within the church are concerned that, are we really a fringe element outside of what people really believe in the pews? And that's a concern.
Yeah.
And that's a concern when I come up to Holden, etc. A lot of people who I've also met on the way to Holden many times, or places like this, have said, I'm sick of being on the left all the time. I like to go to a place where I feel sort of middle of the road. And when I come to Holden, I feel that way. And I'm serious about that. But that's part of the problem in the pews. The part of the problem in the pews is you're sitting next to a lot of people who may not believe 90% of the gospel of Jesus Christ in terms of the radical nature of what he's actually saying and how it applies to life.
Yeah, that's a good point. I gave a presentation like this at a seminary in California. I won't mention the name. When I was finished, I said, well, are there, open it up. Are there any questions or comments? And one student sat right next to me and said, if I preached anything like that in my church, I'd get fired. Yeah. And I said to him, well, wasn't Christ crucified? Which didn't make me real popular with the class. I got a laugh, but people then became quite angry.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
This is what I was referring to when I'm talking about the perceived voluntary nature of our association with churches. And pastors that I have gotten to know well struggle with that as an issue because they're aware that sometimes the majority of the people out in the congregation perceive themselves there strictly as volunteers, mm-hmm. voluntary based. They're there because they want to, and if you say something that rubs my fur the wrong way, I'm gone. And
I think that's the wrong attitude to have.
Oh, yeah, it is.
Because, you know, it seems to me, part of the problem we have is we do have a kind of a shopping cart mentality in this country. It's why, I don't know, you know, if you've seen like the Amish, they have a form of shunning as a form of discipline. You know, if you mess up in that community, you can become ostracized. Well, you know, in most of our other religious communities, particularly in disciple communities, my own denomination, if you fall out with the pastor over any number of issues, you just go down the street to another church and transfer your membership. You talk about you're not excommunicated, there's no sanction whatsoever. And so I think that does frighten pastors on one hand, but on the other hand, what's the point in feeding people pablum week after week and then wondering why all you have are babies? You know, I mean, at that point it becomes your fault too. You know, you can't fault them. You know, if you just keep giving them the same pap week after week.
Just one comment. I would really like to see more pastors, and I don't speak for the Lutheran Church because we're not Lutheran, who are willing to stand up and say, Jesus was popular with a very small group of people. And look what happened to him. I think to live the gospel truly in every aspect of your life is to be a radical right now. And how, if we get off of our butts, out of the seats in the pews, and go out and live the gospel, we are all going to be very much transformed, and we're not going to be the people we are right now if we're not involved. And if we live in a society that legislates morality like capital punishment and abortion and anything else, then you, by the virtue of the fact that you call yourself Christian, you damn well better be a radical. There's no other way to do it. And if you're talking amongst yourselves and your pastor looks out at the congregation and sees a mirror image of himself or herself and he doesn't like what he sees or she sees, then you need to change that congregation. And you can talk to a lot of your young people who are down working in Arizona and California building shelters for poor people and that sort of thing and have seen poverty in the face and lived it. And they change it if they were up in the pulpit. I can tell you that for sure.
Yeah, I hope they
and
keep
that speaks across.
I hope they keep that fire as they go through theological education.
Yeah.
Yes, you're going to have the last word.
Talking about keeping the waters calm and everything, Harriet Tubman says, when you walk through the waters, they're going to get muddy. And there's going to be change when you come through the other side.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess what slightly depresses me is I see more fire in this room than I generally do in my classroom. And that can be depressing sometimes because, the comment I got before, you know, if I preach that, I'll get fired, is more typical of my students. And we have to do something in theological education because, frankly, I've been teaching at seminary, I've finished 8 years, and for every radical student I come across, I have other students who basically are studying to get, you know, very large, comfortable churches and nice suburbs in which they get good retirement benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I struggle with that. But I also am happy doing what I do because at least I have an opportunity to present people with some alternatives. And also, my first profession, which was practicing law, I never could find lawyers who were interested in justice. So finally, I threw in the towel and realized I wasn't going to win at that one. But thank you for your time and patience. And I guess we have a chance to talk some more and also to enjoy Vespers. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks.